This is Rural Health Leadership Radio.
Episode 33, a conversation with Nikki King, Administrative Fellow at Margaret Mary Health.
We've had issues with drugs in the past, but I think most people would agree we've never seen anything like we've got today.
Welcome to the Rural Health Leadership Radio with your host, Dr. Bill Oxier. Each week, Dr. Oxier has a conversation with a different rural health leader to discuss what's working and what's not working in rural health, along with other topics of interest to rural health leaders. Rural Health Leadership Radio's goal is to improve health in rural America by providing a simple, no-cost means to share information and connect rural health leaders from around the country. And now, here's Dr. Oxier with today's guest.
Hi, everybody. I'm your host, Dr. Bill Oxier, and welcome to Rural Health Leadership Radio. I'm privileged to have as today's guest, Nikki King, the Administrative Fellow at Margaret Mary Health in Batesville, Indiana. Nikki was born and raised in the coal fields of Central Appalachia. She graduated with a degree in economics from the University of Kentucky and is a loyal Wildcats fan, and she recently completed her formal studies in the Masters of Health Sciences Administration program at Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio. Before entering the healthcare industry, Nikki worked for the Center of Business and Economic Research studying economic development in southeastern Kentucky. Currently, she's completing her administrative fellowship at Margaret Mary Health, a critical access hospital in rural Indiana. Nikki has combined her life experiences with her formal training to portray the challenges facing rural America, both on the regional and national stage. Nikki, welcome to Rural Health Leadership Radio.
Thank you very much, Dr. Oxy. Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate it. We, just so our listening audience knows, you and I met at DC a couple of weeks ago at the Rural Health Policy Meeting, where you just started your fellowship, the National Rural Health Association Fellowship in Rural Health. So congratulations on being accepted into that program, and good luck in the coming year with that program.
Thank you very much. I'm just happy to be here. Happy to be along for the ride.
That's wonderful. So you are a student of healthcare and rural health, and leadership is vitally important to us in rural health. So, Nikki, what's your definition of leadership?
So, for me, you know, I think you hear a lot of definitions of leadership. And I think a lot of them encompass some things about management, which is, you know, selecting a good team, finding a good fit, getting people to work together, and really developing people to be their personal best, bringing everybody up with you, so to speak. But you know, and I think all those things are true. But to me, one of the things that's really become critical about leadership is it's having vision. I see a lot of people who become leaders because they were good managers, but they don't really have a very good ability to see beyond tomorrow and to really imagine and put plans into action for things that won't be realized for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road. Things that they might never see the end of. So I think that vision is very important.
Yes, I would agree with you. Vision is important. So thank you for sharing that definition with us. So
thank you.
You know, you started your career after you graduated from college, not in healthcare, and now you've shifted to healthcare as an occupation. Why did you choose to do that? Why healthcare?
Well, I was always interested in rural areas. Growing up in eastern Kentucky, one of the things that, you know, was just kind of facet of life there is the boom and bust with the mine industry. So we'd go for a while and the economy would be going good. And then all of a sudden the mines would go out and everyone has to leave or everyone's laid off. And suddenly you're in this huge economic depression. And I mean, it was just near constant cycles with that. So, you know, I really wanted to find ways that rural America could maintain really healthy, vibrant, diversified economies in a small scale, because you hear a lot of people say that you can't do it. You're too small. You know, you can't compete with these urban centers, but I don't think that's true. I think we've got a lot of strengths that are particular to small communities that we don't necessarily leverage sometimes. So I went in to study that. And what I found from that was actually the importance of healthcare, because in most communities, that is number one, number two, number three biggest employer. It might be the only employer that has a very strong invested interest in the continued health of that community. And once a community loses their hospital, the ability to rebuild that community is just substantially, you know, just handicapped.
Yes. Yeah.
You, in the current environment, you know, you've got almost 700 small hospitals that are getting ready to go out of business. 40% of rural hospitals are operating at a negative margin. To get a new rural hospital would just not happen. So once it's gone, it's gone. And then no young families aren't going to want to move in that area. They don't have a hospital to take their kids to. Older people aren't going to retire to that area if they don't have an ER that's convenient. And so it just severely limits your ability to recover. So I started studying healthcare.
You know, I think it's interesting because, you know, you studied economic development first, right?
Yep.
And so then you made the link that rural healthcare, rural hospitals are part of the economic development of rural America. So good for you.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you've done a lot of work and research into the opiate epidemic, which you made a presentation that I heard while we were in D.C. together. So I know you've done a lot of work researching that. Can you share with us a historical overview of how we got to where we are?
So what really happened is, you know, we've had issues with drugs in the past, but I think most people would agree we've never seen anything like we've got today. And this really came up as two-pronged. Part of that was the heroin that was coming out of places like Mexico on the West Coast. But I won't speak to that as much as I will the part that I know best, which is Central Appalachia, which became ground zero of the OxyContin epidemic. There's a company called Purdue Pharma that had identified Central Appalachia as being an area that had, I guess you could call it a marked need for pain management. They had just developed this pill. At the time, they were a pretty small fry pharmacy company, and they had identified Central Appalachia based on the high percentage of work injuries from the mines and the lumber industry, as well as having a much higher than normal rate of veterans that had, you know, chronic injury from Vietnam. And they also determined that the doctors in that area were not keeping up with their continuing education like their urban counterparts, and were actually getting most of their drug and pharmacy information from the pharmaceutical reps that were coming out. And so from all that, they determined that they really wanted to focus their marketing efforts there. And I've heard it said anecdotally that they spent more on marketing in just 6 counties in eastern Kentucky than they did the entire state of New York. When I was going to school, they used to give out pink teddy bears with OxyContin advertisements on them, just to give you an example. And it paid back in dividends. You know, they call it hillbilly heroin now. They were giving it out for everything because they were erroneously quoting a quote-unquote study. It wasn't a study. It was a letter that was written that said that it was non-addictive. And so a lot of the doctors were operating under the information that it was not addictive, or at least not very addictive. And so they were giving it out hand over fist because this is the miracle pain relief. And they got a bunch of people addicted. I would say one of the things that has really been missing from this discussion about Purdue Pharma is, and by the way, the executives ended up going to prison for that. They killed a couple thousand people, and they ended up, they at least were charged, put it that way. So that did come to punitive action. They determined that was predatory marketing practice. But I don't know whether this was the original intention, but because of the boom and bust of the mine industries, what would happen is when the mines would go out, you would have these huge out-migration of people going north to the factories to find work. And then as soon as the mines would come back, those people would come back to eastern Kentucky where the families were and the roots were. And, you know, being Appalachian, you know, we are a cultural minority. It's hard to live outside of the area sometimes. So a lot of people want to come back. So they would go and they would work here, you know, in the factories in Batesville and Indiana. And sometimes they would come back, sometimes they wouldn't, different things like that. So what nobody really expected was a way that the opioid epidemic would grow outside of Central Appalachia, because they were taking it with them. So, for example, you know, I feel like a lot of people know about Scott County, Indiana, Austin, which is where the HIV outbreak epidemic was recently. And what a lot of people don't know is the vast majority of those people are actually Appalachian transplants. So they are, in fact, almost the entire population that suffers from that are very strongly Appalachian, either directly or secondarily Appalachian.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I don't think people really expected the way that it spread out. And I don't know that people have necessarily done a lot of study or connection, but if you look at the maps of the opioid death rates back in 2000, the only red spot is on eastern Kentucky. But if you fast forward a few years, you watch that red spot grow from eastern Kentucky outwards, and it almost looks like an epidemiological map of disease spread, like any other disease, like flu or cold or anything.
Well, thank you. I know that you and I, we discussed the book Dreamland when we were met each other, and I know that they suggest that the epidemic started in Kentucky, but right outside of Portsmouth, Ohio, where you're saying it's more in Appalachia. I say Appalachia, you're pronouncing it differently than me, so hopefully you know better than I do on how to say that. Sorry about that.
I'll forgive you.
Okay, thank you. So what's different about this opiate epidemic in rural America?
So one of the things that I believe makes the opioid epidemic in rural America especially deadly is EMS response times. A lot of rural communities don't have the funds to fund their EMS, you know, like an urban area. So what'll happen is you'll have one, two paramedics that you share over this giant region, but most ambulances run with EMTs or underfunded. A lot of times they're volunteers, and just terrain issues by the very definition of being rural, you know, mountainous areas and in Appalachia. But then, you know, you look out west and you've got these very sparsely populated areas in North Dakota, where you've got two people on average per every square mile on these giant farms. And so the travel times are substantial. Well, what's really different about this drug compared to drugs in the past is that with opioids, either heroin or OxyContin, either one, that once they overdose, the issue is that they have stopped breathing. So when people call 911, it's usually because they found somebody and they're unresponsive, or they're turning blue, or something to that effect. Well, it's the thing about breathing is that people kind of like to do it more than once every 40 minutes, which is what the EMS response times are in some of these areas. So even when the EMS get out there, you know, it's sometimes really difficult to treat, because, you know, you have nasal Narcan, which is what a regular EMT will use, but each dose takes about 3 minutes to know if it worked or not. And then you need to give them additional doses, and that'll be an additional 3 minutes. So on top of the already long wait time, only being able to give like nasal Narcan, which isn't nearly as strong as IV Narcan, also adds, you know, maybe 5-10 more minutes on top of that person's going without oxygen. Because of that, it makes, you know, this a particularly deadly epidemic in rural America. And even if you have a paramedic on every ambulance, that's not necessarily going to get better without some real creativity because of the issues with terrain, et cetera.
What about the reimbursement issues for treatment?
Well, what reimbursement? Okay. You know, Medicaid has picked up and has started paying a little bit for reimbursement. The problem is when you look at the addicts, you've got some of them that are private pay insurance, and some of the private pay insurance will pay you something. A lot of them are on Medicaid. Medicaid has historically paid abysmally for this. They're starting to get a little better, but nothing like cost. You know, you're not going to recoup your money. Any kind of addiction treatment that you run is going to be a significant loss. Okay. I mean, and when you look at, again, as I mentioned before, almost 700 hospitals are closing in rural areas, and 40% of them are at a negative margin. The people who are most likely to die from the opioid epidemics are most likely to be going to hospitals that are already losing money. Mm-hmm. Their ability to continue to add service lines that they know will be substantial losses is limited, especially, you know, you'll lose money on outpatient treatment, but you'll really lose money on inpatient treatment. Right. And so you've got a couple of hospitals out there that are holding on to inpatient psych units. But, you know, the ability and the viability for other hospitals to jump into that to improve coverage or to, you know, continue to offer those services in the future is significantly a question.
Well, I know that you've studied different models of treatment. What can you tell us about the different models of treatment?
Well, when you look at rural America, I think going forward, for anybody who's looking at adding this, I personally would recommend a hub and spoke kind of model, because, again, for that cost factor, you know, if you're talking about a hospital that has only a very narrow margin or a negative margin, your financial viability, if you add inpatient treatment, is going to be significantly altered. Without patient treatment, you would basically utilize, you know, rely heavily on mid-level providers. They're a little easier to get, a little more affordable, because none of this even touches the issue of trying to get a psychiatrist in a rural area, which is, you know, like trying to find a unicorn. With the hub and spoke model, you would, you know, create some kind of arrangement with a larger facility that offers the inpatient treatment, that you've got some kind of reliable way to get your patients in that treatment for the detox part of it. And then once they detox, they would come back into the rural community. That you need to make sure you've got a very strong continuum of care so these people aren't falling through the crack. But then it would be something like, you know, a mid-level provider to do individual therapy sessions with them, a doctor, probably primary care, who manages medically assisted treatment, the medication part of it, and then hopefully someone doing some kind of group therapy, peer mentoring kind of programs as well. So you've got something like a family therapist that's doing group sessions, and then something like, you know, Narcotics Anonymous. To create kind of a buddy system. All this together comes out to be a lot more affordable. Again, still lost, but more affordable, and getting in a range that people can live on and actual care that people can provide in rural areas in regards to physician coverage.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. So, Nikki, you are a fountain of information on this topic, and thank you for what you've shared with us so far. Right now, we're going to take a short break to hear a word from our sponsor. Then we're going to be right back to continue our conversation with today's guest, Nikki King, Administrative Fellow at Margaret Mary Health. Most successful rural health leaders and managers today have a good understanding of the various management tools and skills required to lead an organization successfully. Therefore, the major leadership challenges for managers and executives today is not understanding the practice of leadership, but practicing their understanding of leadership. For successful organization leaders to become more effective, leadership change needs to be positive, sustained, recognized and acknowledged by their stakeholders and others. The Dynamic Leadership Academy for Rural Health utilizes stakeholder-centered coaching, a real-life, on-the-job process that is highly effective and time-efficient. Accelerating leadership growth and effectiveness is about changing behaviors and creating new processes and habits while interacting with other stakeholders on the job. In rural health, leadership makes the difference. The difference with financial success, clinical success, and delivering value. Leadership effectiveness drives profits and value. If you're a successful rural health leader looking for greater success for you, your team, or your hospital, call or email us today to schedule a free no-obligation discovery call. Call 813-658-0422 or send an email to bill@billoxier.com today. There is no risk for you. If the Dynamic Leadership Academy for Rural Health doesn't produce results, there's no fee. No growth, no fee. So call or email today to get your discovery session scheduled. We're having a very interesting conversation today with Nikki King, Administrative Fellow at Margaret Mary Health, a critical access hospital in Batesville, Indiana. And right before the break, Nikki, you were sharing with us some models for treatment for addiction and that. So I know you've emphasized a focus on mental health, the mental health aspect of this epidemic. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, my stump speech is always the same because this is the easiest way that I can explain it. You know, I graduated in class of, I think, about 186. And I know it's upwards of 10, maybe as many as 20 that have been directly impacted by the opioid epidemic already, between ODs and car wrecks or things like that. You know, my argument is this: when we sat down in the classroom at 5, none of us drew a picture of the day that we were going to grow up and be heroin addicts. You know, we drew doctors or lawyers or vets or something like that. But nobody dreams about the day that they're selling crack on the corner. Mm-hmm. But we know that, you know, some people start as young as 14, but the average age of an addict is somewhere around 22. So we lost them somewhere between 5 and 22, you know, and I think this has a much broader application in the sense that, you know, when I sat around my classroom at the age of 14, I could have pointed out to you everyone that would be hooked on drugs today or dead from an overdose, and I would have been right almost 100% of the time. And it wasn't, you know, I feel like when you get a lot of the older generation looking down, they're thinking of the drug addictions of their day when they look at my generation. So they're expecting the kids to grow up in poverty or the kids to grow up in homes with domestic violence, that other side of the track upbringing. And so they're really just shocked when it's the kids from the good household and they can't really wrap their head around it. But to me, this has been us kicking the can down the road on mental health since the 60s, since One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Okay. You know, because what I saw was a lot of significant issues with self-esteem, significant depression, significant anxiety. So what would happen is you've got this kid who does fantastic in sports, fantastic student. Everybody just kind of knows anecdotally that they get really wound up about school or anything like that, about any kind of failure. But nobody expects a day that they're going to start self-medicating themselves for anxiety disorders. And you talk about, you know, the kids who grew up in a blue collar family, good hardworking family, and how, you know, they're depressed, but it must be attention, right? And I was like that at that age. You know, I had too many feelings, hormones, teenagers, you know, somebody probably broke up with them. And then, you know, and then they're self-medicating for depression. You know, and in my class, it was the prom queen. It was the honor student. It was the valedictorian. It was, you know, it was the blue collar families. It was the white collar families. It was the mayor's kid. It was, you know, it was those other side of the track kids that everybody thought it would be. But nobody really seemed to put together the bread trail of what was connecting them. And there was significant underlying mental health issues. And people talk about, you know, well, back when I was in school and we walked uphill both ways, we didn't have these mental health issues. What's going on? And I think in part that's true, but I think one of the missing pieces is that, coping mechanisms. So, for example, Eastern Kentucky is one of the leading regions in the nation for childhood obesity, and it was because we actually have the most productive Taco Bell in the country in Hazard, Kentucky, a town with 5,000 people in it. And there was a study from UVA Wise and Wake Forest that studied why that was through the College of Nursing. And what they found was that overwhelmingly those kids aren't learning how to cook. And when you talk about 50% of the kids in Knott County being raised by someone other than their parents, and 33% of the kids in Harlan County are habitually homeless, chronically homeless, you know, there's not really the family structures that there used to be to teach stuff like this. And our home ec courses, like so many things, have been gutted. So, but I think aside from that, kids aren't learning coping mechanisms from their parents like they used to, as well as things like cooking. So when they are met with these self-esteem issues, when they're met with an extreme degree of bullying that we have now through social media, I don't know that we're always equipping them well to handle that. And so, and that just spirals.
Yeah, talk about a perfect storm. Well, that's certainly tragic. So thank you for that analysis. So what do we need to do? How do we break this cycle?
Personally, I would really like to see it become a norm to have therapists readily available in school. A lot of schools, the teachers don't have confidence in their counselors. The students don't have confidence in their counselors. I can't tell you how many kids I know that say that they don't feel like their school guidance counselors care one way or the other, right, or that the school guidance counselors are just missing it. Whether or not that's true, it's the perception. So that's part of it. Part of it is because schools that do have a good therapy offering, like around here in Batesville, we have excellent therapists, but they stay busy all day long with the kids who are just obstructing class. They don't necessarily ever get a referral or even hear about kids who are great students, who are great in class, but they are depressed and they're talking about suicide and they're drawing really disturbing images and things like that. And they never even hear about those kids a lot of times because they're not creating a problem. I would like to see therapy and coping mechanisms and good mental health and hygiene practices taught as a regular part of school.
And are you talking about high school or are you talking about earlier than that?
I think honestly, it should start as early as late elementary, middle school, because, you know, you talk about creating a new norm and really changing behaviors. You really want them to have this as part of their mindset before they need it.
So I'm afraid to ask you this question because I think I know what the answer is, but what scares you the most about the future of rural health?
Well, what really scares me is the way that some areas leaders will cloister. Because, you know, going into this new era, I'm not going to lie, it's as scary as it's ever been. You know, our hospitals are in significant danger. Rural America is significantly struggling. We're a smaller percent of the population than we've ever been. A lot of the jobs that have typically sustained these areas are going out. You know, coal mining is really struggled. The steel industry has struggled. Now, healthcare leaders are more important in their communities, even beyond their facilities, than they've ever been, and having that voice at the table. And I worry that sometimes we kind of get in this mindset where it's like, you know, we've got our own set of problems here. Nobody really has their problems. Nobody really understands, or, you know, this kind of woe is me. I'm trying to make it through tomorrow. How am I going to think about what our community is going to look like in 10 years when I don't know if I can make payroll at the end of the week? But really, you know, this is what scares me is that we're not connecting with each other, because what I think will shock everyone, and I know shocked me, is how similar a town's problems in rural California can be to a small town in Appalachia or a small town in southern Indiana. You know, we really have the same challenges in a lot of ways, and we can share a lot of good ideas because we really have a unique opportunity to approach healthcare and the economy from a community standpoint that urban communities don't have. And I think it's really just leveraging those ideas and really coming together as communities. But all these communities need a strong leader to stand up on that. And I believe healthcare is uniquely poised to provide those leaders. We just need those people to stand up and to work together with people, with their peers across the country.
Well, thank you for that answer. And I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's one of the reasons I created Rural Health Leadership Radio, is to connect rural health leaders around the country, because even though in your example, a critical access hospital in California versus a critical access hospital in Eastern Kentucky or Southern Indiana, there are similar challenges that are faced. There's also unique challenges, but we can all learn from each other. So I appreciate your answer on that question. So that's what scares you about the future. What excites you the most about the future, Nikki?
Honestly, I'm completely excited about the future. And I know that makes people laugh. But, you know, I always say that the night's always darkest before the dawn. The good thing about starting from such a low place is we've really only got up to go. But we really get the opportunity to decide for the first time, I think, in the history of healthcare in this country, what is healthcare really going to look like in the future? And there's so many things that we are uniquely poised to do as rural communities that the advantage of the urban places don't have. For example, you know, most rural hospitals are the only game in town. They're the only hospital. And because of that, they have a population that is theirs. For example, I know our service area is about 65,000 people, and they are only Margaret Mary people. You know, so any services that we provide out there to the community, you don't have to like check every single penny to know that you are going to really reap the benefits of improving the entire health of your community, because they're your community. If you're in a city and you get sick, and you say you go through some kind of high blood pressure program that was completely free by one urban hospital, and you call 911 near another urban hospital, well, you're just going to go to whatever hospital you're closest to. You know, you don't really have that same loyalty, and the hospital isn't a part of the community in the same sense that it is when it's your neighbor who works there, and it's your sister in the ER doctor, and, you know, the hospital CEO is your second cousin twice removed. So it really gives us a unique opportunity to bring in really different things, like, you know, parish nursing programs, to really bring those back up and really beef those out in such a way that we can really control the health outcomes of our community in a way that we were never able to before, as well as participating in things like the economic development, to really create these little healthy, vibrant communities that are built around healthy behaviors.
Yes. Well, it's hard not to get excited to hear you talking about it.
Thank you.
So we've covered a lot of ground in the short time we've been talking to each other today, Nikki. So if our listeners only take away one thing from our conversation today, what should that be?
I would say if you take only one thing, is don't give up. You know, don't think this is the end. Don't despair. Have hope. Because I talk to so many leaders who are working at these hospitals that are struggling, and they just don't see any way that they're getting through tomorrow. You know, they're looking at macro, they're looking at all these changes. And it's so hard for them to dream about the future when they don't know if they're going to make payroll at the end of the week. But, you know, I think you really got to believe we're doing extremely important work, completely necessary work. We're saving the lives of our communities. And, you know, at the end of all of this, we are going to be not only, I believe, providing top-notch care, but also proving that we've been providing it all along, and we've just not really been tracking that sort of thing. So I would say, just take heart. You're doing the Lord's work. And, you know, I don't think this is the end of rural America or rural health. I think this is just a new chapter.
Nikki King, Administrative Fellow at Margaret Mary Health, a critical access in Batesville, Indiana. Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your thoughts and observations and the research that you've done on the opioid epidemic in America. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate you.
And I want to thank all of you out there for listening today. And if you enjoyed today, today's episode, please go to iTunes or Stitcher, Google Play, whatever your favorite podcast app might be, and subscribe to Rural Health Leadership Radio. And if you'd like to leave a rating or review in iTunes, you can go to our website, www.rhlradio.com, and click on the iTunes link. And to continue the conversation of leadership in rural health, you can also join our LinkedIn group called Rural Health Leadership Radio. Until next week, let's keep working to improve healthcare in rural America.
If you would like to connect with today's guest, please send an email with your contact information to bill@billoxier.com. If you would like to be a guest or suggest someone else as a guest, have a question you would like to ask, or simply want to contact Rural Health Leadership Radio, please use that same email address, bill@billoxier.com. That's bill@billaxier.com. You can also visit our website at www.rhlradio.com.
We'd ask that you please support our sponsor, the Dynamic Leadership Academy for Rural Health. The Dynamic Leadership Academy for Rural Health's mission is to improve rural health one leader at a time.